Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
And Fred, you're also the webmaster for the esteemed Creation Research Society. I love those guys.
Yes, and today we're going to talk about kangaroos, Bob. Kangaroos and you.
Kangaroos and me? What do I have in common with a kangaroo?
Well, it turns out you've got quite a bit in common with a kangaroo.
I thought I only had a lot in common with chimpanzees, but yeah, you're right. Now, this show will build on two previous Real Science Friday shows. Remember, Fred, the beginning of 2009, we did a show on the Evolutionist magazine cover story, Darwin Was Wrong, on the Tree of Life.
That's right, and we've got a couple of articles in Creation Magazine that we're going to go through that continue to show that the Tree of Life is
the wrong. Tree of Life was wrong, that you can trace back all creatures through an evolutionary pathway through their branches to the trunk and so on. Genetics has proved, even to evolutionist scientists, thousands of them, that that's wrong. Darwin was wrong on the Tree of Life, and this also is going to build on the editor for Creation Research Society Quarterly, Kevin Anderson, who was in studio recently here. He's a molecular biologist, and he was talking about the wonders of DNA.
That's right. Excellent talk. He was at our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship group, and yeah. Highly recommend you try to make our Friday meeting, second Friday of every month at Bethlehem Lutheran Church.
Yeah, it's a wonderful group, the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. Okay, so Fred, tell me about kangaroos and me. Why am I like a kangaroo?
Well, are you feeling jumpy?
Yeah.
Okay, well, researchers at Australia's government-backed Center of Excellence for Kangaroo Genomics have mapped the genetic code of these kangaroos.
So then, wait a minute, they have a Center for Kangaroo Genomics?
Yeah, that just specializes in mapping out the genome of these marsupials.
I never knew there was such a center, the Center for Kangaroo DNA.
I wonder if it's a big skyscraper.
It must be. And they've now completed their project, or at least they have sequenced kangaroo DNA, and lo and behold, according to their director, Jenny Graves, Jenny said that there are great chunks of the human genome. Now, evolutionists listening to this program, if you don't have your seatbelt on, you should put your seatbelt on.
That's right.
If you're standing up at home, sit down. All right. Great chunks of the human genome. And Fred, we're going to get into how this utterly destroys Darwin's other theory, natural selection. Great chunks of the human genome are sitting right there in the kangaroo genome. This is startling. In fact, according to a report in Australia's national newspaper, the kangaroo has 20,000 genes that are identifiable. That's the same number as in humans. And according to Jenny, the Kangaroo Center director, they are largely the same as the genes in people, and that a lot of those genes are in the same order. Fred, they said we're like chimpanzees. We're like kangaroos.
Yeah, well, they're not mentioning, you know, the percentage similarity, but it sounds like we're very similar. It's embarrassing for them
very
to come out
embarrassing.
And say. Because I thought all this time that my great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy was a kind of a chimpanzee kind of type creature.
Yeah.
But I guess it was
some
a
kind
marsupial
of monkey
hopping around.
Yeah, so what's with that? Are we supposed to be close relatives to kangaroos like we are to Lucy and Australopithecus and all those?
Well, I didn't think so. Do I look like a kangaroo?
No, you don't, Ashley. Now, we're on radio, so I could get away with a lot. Yeah. But you don't look like a kangaroo. But now, you know, birth control is an issue. And it turns out that when a woman goes through, you know, change of life and all that, hot flashes, that the OBGYN has to sew up her pouch. That's one of the things that women do when they're about, you know, in about 70.
Oh, so there are some. Boy, I didn't know that.
Did you know that? So, yeah. So we are not like kangaroos. Kangaroos are not supposed to be our close relatives. But lo and behold, hey, we're just like kangaroos. So when the evolutionist said, look, we're just like chimpanzees, they didn't know it, but they were being duped by their own theory.
That's right. And, you know, they would claim things like our DNA was 97% similar to chimpanzees.
Right.
And, I mean, that's an illusion in itself, because that 3% is actually a huge portion of, that's a lot of nucleotides, these little
right.
pieces of DNA. It's like on the order of 90 million differences. So
right.
They don't really tell you what's behind the story. We talked about this in a past show with the junk DNA. We're finding out there's not any junk DNA, so our similarity
the
with
junk
chimps...
junk is not junk, so the similarity with chimps is not like they exaggerated it to be.
Exactly. It's probably 90% or less. It's nowhere near 97%.
So that... but now it turns out we have the same kind of similarity with kangaroos.
With kangaroos, that's right. I like what an evolutionist actually said. You know, he was talking about the chimp human DNA similarity.
Yeah.
And he noted that, well, hey, you know, we're 50% similar to bananas, but we don't look like a banana.
Yeah, exactly. And now that was Stephen Jones, right? He's a leading evolutionist geneticist. And he says, come on, we're supposed to be like chimps. We share 50% of our DNA with bananas, and that doesn't make us half banana.
That's right.
Right.
But evolutionists do believe that we are related to a banana.
Right, exactly. Fred, we did the show on the Tree of Life, and the reason evolutionists, like at New Scientist, are coming up blatantly saying Darwin was wrong on the Tree of Life, they say Darwin had two theories. The Tree of Life, that every creature is related, and you could trace their evolutionary pathway from the twigs of the Tree of Life through to the branches, to the trunk, and down to the root.
That's right.
Right? So all reptiles would be, go ahead, in the root.
Yeah, the root would be basically a piece of slime in the pre-mortal soup.
Yeah, exactly. And making me hungry. And so the scientists today, the evolutionary scientists, like at New Scientist magazine, they're saying Darwin was wrong because we've now sequenced genomic material, DNA material, from thousands of species. And lo and behold, you cannot trace a genetic pathway from like reptiles or all insects. They're just, it doesn't work. You've got genes and proteins from widely flung organisms that are almost identical and their close neighbors don't have them.
That's right. They should be far apart on this tree. If you can imagine a tree and you're near the top,
yeah.
Kangaroos should be quite a bit of distance from humans, but they're right next to them. Well, they don't think that they're not going to say that we've got a recent common ancestor with a kangaroo-like human.
Like a snail, right. Yeah, right. Like a snail and a bat, right? A snail and a bat. They shouldn't share more similarity than a bat and a rat, say. So they're saying these are evolutionists. We knew it all along. Darwin was wrong about the Tree of Life. So his second theory was natural selection, that this is how all these differences came about through survival. And so nature would select small differences. Now, later in the show, we're going to present, forget the kangaroos, we're going to look at the entire animal kingdom from the evolutionist, and they're going to see that they are demolishing Darwin's natural selection.
Well, genetics just kills it. I mean, their Tree of Life is not a tree, it's a tumbleweed.
So now, Fred, before we get to that, to the blueprint for the entire animal kingdom and all its similarity, could we talk about the energy molecules in all of our trillions of cells? What are those energy molecules called?
They're called ATPs.
ATP, and they have to be synthesized, right? ATP, it's sort of like a little battery or billions of little batteries. Not really batteries, but energy molecules that our cells, we have trillions of cells, our cells need these ATP energy molecules to do all the functions they do. And what makes these energy molecules, these ATP, are the world's tiniest rotary motors, and they make these energy-rich molecules. It's just extraordinary.
That's right. It's called the ATP synthase protein that makes these energy molecules, and this reaction occurs about a million times per minute.
Whoa. A million times per minute in our body's cells. So each cell, a million times per minute, they're making an energy molecule.
That's right. They call it the energy currency of life. It's kind of like oil in a car, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or gasoline, really.
It's like exactly.
It's like the gasoline, and then you have a sophisticated engine to change one kind of energy into another kind of energy, so the car will go.
That's right. But, you know, in a car, you need to put in the gasoline, whereas these cells, there's this protein, this ATP synthase is creating, is producing,
the
is
energy
making
from,
this gasoline.
From
this,
raw materials.
This chemical energy mm-hmm. that is used throughout the cell to do things like, mm-hmm. You know, making DNA and RNA and
right.
cleaning up debris, doing the quality control system that we've talked about on prior shows, all these things that happen within the cell.
Exactly. And so it not only helps this energy molecule, this ATP, helps with everything that's going on inside the living cell. It helps with manufacturing the DNA. It helps with RNA and proteins and cleaning up debris and transporting chemicals into the cells and out of the cells. So this ATP, this is crucial stuff.
It is, and it's really neat how it works. The energy is in a form of a hydrogen ion.
Hydrogen ion? Now, I'm not very technical. That's like a proton.
Hydrogen ions pour through this protein, this ATP synthase, like wind through a windmill.
Wait a minute. When wind goes through a windmill, it turns the turbine, and you could make energy.
That's right. And so what happens is you're producing this gradient of hydrogen atoms, and it causes this ATP synthase. There's a structure.
This motor.
A motor starts to spin. The axis
rotary,
and the base.
A rotary motor?
Yes, it starts to spin.
You're serious.
It's amazing. And this thing is really tiny. It boggles the imagination.
Well, there are countless of these little motors inside every cell we have in our body. You already said that this happens a million times per minute in each of the cells, and we have trillions of cells in our body.
That's right. And not only that, these machines spin at about 9,000 RPM, according to this article.
Wow.
That's revolutions per minute.
Wait a minute. 9,000 revolutions per minute? So you have a tiny rotary motor. Now, if I get in my car and I rev up the engine, I might see when I'm idling, I might be at 1,000 or 2,000 RPM. Is that right? Revolutions per minute?
Yeah,
I get on the highway, I might go up to 3,000 or 4,000 RPM.
And this is 9,000 RPM.
Fred, I'd be in the red on my car. My tachometer would be in the red, Fred. I'd be in the danger zone if I took my car's motor to 9,000 RPM.
And what that would lead to is that little red light that says service engine soon.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Now, it turns out that as these hydrogen protons, these ions, that's the fuel. These are just tiny subatomic particles that are going through this motor, this protein. And as they're going through, it's spinning, and scientists have calculated that nearly 100% of the spin is converted into chemical energy. Fred, almost 100%. It can't be 100%. It can't be.
Amazing efficiency.
Amazing. So far beyond anything we have ever been able to produce for, you know, energy management.
So what's really cool is, so you got this motor spinning, and it's producing energy, and it's going to produce these ATP molecules, mm-hmm. these energy molecules.
Right.
Well, what's fascinating, even more so than we've already talked about, one revolution of this motor
when
produces...
When it spins once?
Once. Oh. How many does the article say that it produces of these molecules?
Three
molecules. So
now,
again, it's going 9,000 per minute.
This is incredible. So it spins once, this tiny molecular rotary motor. It spins once, and every time it spins once, it makes three ATP molecules.
That's right.
Energy molecules.
Energy molecules for the cell to use wherever, you know, is needed. And
Fred, I know how many protons it needs to spin once.
You do?
Yeah.
How many?
10.
10 proteins.
Could you imagine 10 protons, subatomic particles, 10 little ions go through this turbine? Just 10. I mean, there are trillions of atoms in your finger, you know, trillions. You take 10 protons, 10 ions, and they go through this rotary engine, and it spins once, and it makes three energy molecules, three ATP.
It's mind-boggling how...
It's absolutely mind-boggling. Now, this little motor has three parts. It has a head, and it has a base, and it has a stationary part. It's just wild, Fred. This thing, if you can imagine a button on your shirt, and a button goes through the buttonhole. Well, you have a surface within a cell, and these ATP synthase rotary motors, they attach to a surface. So they need something stationary to attach to, and it's like you have a buttonhole in the surface, and then the button pops through. That's the engine. That's the rotary engine. Well, you know what's interesting about this thing is if it's needed somewhere else, the buttonhole just moves. So it moves along the surface of some structure. So it moves wherever it's, you know, it's needed. And there's this, so if you can imagine a sort of rotary, a round column where the hydrogen ions go into the column. They go up through the column and they come out the head. And as they go through, it spins the column, it spins the base and the head, and out pop these ATP molecules.
Yeah, it's like a pencil inside a cardboard toilet paper tube.
Oh, there we go.
It was the description they gave in the magazine.
Yeah.
You know, if you get the magazine, you can see the diagrams and the, you know, the graphical presentations of this. Creation Magazine.
Yeah. And so how do evolutionary scientists say this amazing energy plant evolved? Fred, what they've pretty, they're desperate. But what they came up with is this. They said, you know, ATP does this amazing winding thing. It spins, you know. So maybe the ATP synthase evolved from proteins that are used to unwind DNA. You know, our DNA needs to be unwound. So maybe the proteins that unwind the DNA evolved into this ATP synthase.
Well, I think we have a chicken and egg problem here, Bob.
Do we?
Yes.
Why?
Well, doesn't this DNA thing you just talked about, doesn't it need ATP?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, for DNA to be unwound, the DNA needs ATP. The DNA needs ATP. So how could ATP evolve from the DNA functions when the DNA needs ATP? This is replete throughout biology that all these interdependent systems need one another. It's just so funny. DNA can't evolve without the protection of a cell around it. And a cell can't exist without the DNA to design the cell and keep it functioning.
So I think a good idea here would be that it all needs to be in place from the beginning. The thing has to be designed
and
ready to go from the beginning.
You know, Darwin cheated. He described evolution, but he skipped the original appearance of life on Earth. He just skipped that. And so natural selection wouldn't help until you have organisms that are reproducing. Natural selection can't help you develop the first entity that's able to reproduce. It can't help.
Yeah, what's it going to select?
Right. So it's fun, Fred. Okay, so now here's the part of this show that I'm really, really excited about. And it's an article in this Creation magazine from September 2009. It's by David White. And Fred, this article about evolution, and by the way, David White is a trained scientist, including in the area of genetics, and he wrote this assessment of what's called EvoDevo. EvoDevo. These evolutionists, they've come up with a new field, evolutionary developmental biology.
Yeah, it's based off a gene called a Hox gene.
The Hox gene, discovered back in the 80s. And what does the Hox gene do?
Well, the Hox gene, they're development genes that are the blueprint to various parts of the body.
Mm-hmm. And what they're finding out, these are like regulatory genes, right? The Hox gene will say, for example, okay, you're going to have a big toe. Well, start building the big toe during the fetal development stage.
That's right. It's during development. It's a pretty much, again, it's like the architecture of the body.
It provides architecture. That's a good way of saying it. And as we're going to find out now that many of these regulatory genes and other genes exist in a blueprint for the entire animal kingdom, and they exist everywhere, like the human genome, so much of it being in kangaroos. What's it doing in kangaroos? Well, it turns out we're finding out that a good chunk of the blueprint to build a human or to build, you name it, a jumping mouse, is in everything in the whole animal kingdom.
That's right. It's common throughout the animal kingdom. These organisms are diverse as leeches and lawyers and are built using the same developmental genes.
Well, okay, now wait a minute. Organisms as diverse as leeches and lawyers? I don't see much of a difference between leeches and lawyers.
Oh, that's true. Let me use a different example.
Yeah, please do. Actually, the magazine, leeches Creation and, Magazine, says leeches and lawyers.
Yeah, we thought that was funny.
They must have done that on purpose.
I don't think that was, yeah.
Yeah, right. Right.
But leeches and elephants would have the same
developmental genes. Now, that's starting for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, this discovery has come as such a shock that one of the world's most eminent biologists, Sean Carroll, confessed, "No biologist had even the foggiest notion that such similarities could exist between genes of such different animals."
Yeah, so here's the world's leading biologist, Sean Carroll, and he says, we never had the foggiest notion. Fred, they didn't have the foggiest notion because this contradicts evolutionary biology.
How many times do we get quotes like this from evolutionists? So we had no idea. This goes against our way of thinking. This is contrary to what we've been...
It doesn't matter what it is. When they look at a chunk of amber, when they look at comets, every time they say, we're so surprised to find what we're finding over and over. Well, creatures that supposedly diverged millions of years ago, according to Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, shouldn't share the startling similarity in developmental genes that they do. And we're talking about similarity in organs that supposedly developed after some of these other creatures. This is just shocking, Fred.
Oh, I love this quote they have in here by Ernst Mayr. Do you remember him?
Oh yeah. He's the nothing makes sense guy.
Yeah, nothing makes sense in biology except in light of evolution. I don't think nothing makes sense in light of evolution, because evolution is so anti-science. Yeah. But I digress. Ernst Mayr said this, "The search for similar genes is quite futile except in very close relatives."
Okay, now wait a minute. Now that's based on evolutionary theory, right? Now he's considered the Darwin of the 20th century.
Yeah, he says it's futile to expect this to happen.
Yeah.
Another failed prediction of evolution?
Another failed prediction. Now, he died in 2005 recently. And he's described as the world's greatest living evolutionary biologist, except that he's now dead. And Fred, he said that you cannot find similar genes unless you're looking at very close relatives. So maybe if you're looking at two very similar arthropods, maybe you'll find some similar genes. But so that's his prediction based on evolution. But what we know is you find similar genes from bananas to giraffes.
To kangaroos. So in this.
To me and yous.
In this.
We have one creator, designer, God, who made a genetic blueprint for the entire animal kingdom.
That's right. I mean, in this one magazine, there's two articles that refute what this Mayr guy said.
Yeah, right. In this one little article. And there's a whole evolutionary discipline called EvoDevo, evolutionary developmental biology. That's also, Fred, my prediction, and it's obvious to people who read creation publications, but my prediction is not only have they admitted that the tree of life is dead, this is going to force them to admit that natural selection was wrong. And that's the holy grail of the God haters in the world. People who hate God love Darwin and natural selection. This is going to force them, because not only do we share similar developmental genes with fruit flies, but we share them with almost every other creature on the planet.
It's amazing, because without natural selection, and they've never had natural selection anyways to do the things that they said that it did. To me, it flabbergasts me that we allowed to permeate into our science classrooms, our museums, TV, this belief in evolution. It's so built on a house of cards, a house of balsa wood.
It's an evolution fairy tale.
It is. That sounds familiar.
You have a website called evolutionfairytale.com.
.com,
and it's a great website too, Fred. So, for example, when a developmental gene that induces eyes to be formed, imagine that. You've got a Hox gene that makes eyes. Well, researchers have taken a gene from a mouse that begins to form the mouse eye when the mouse is a fetal mouse in its embryonic form. They took a mouse eyeball gene and they inserted it into a fruit fly, and lo and behold, fruit fly eye structures begin to form as a result of the mouse gene. Now, Fred, this is dramatic because, according to evolution and Darwin and all these guys, fruit flies and mice, they diverged over a half a billion years ago, 500 million years ago.
They're supposed to be as far apart on that tree
as
that
you can get.
Fairy tale tree of theirs, yeah.
the only way to get further on that tree is to have what? A mushroom and an eagle. I mean, we're talking about mice and fruit flies, and they have the same blueprint of the regulatory genes, which are so wildly sophisticated.
Yeah, so what it's saying is they use the gene from the mouse, and it turns out it's the same. It does the same thing. So that means they're very similar, probably 100% similar.
Yeah,
they're real close to it.
It's just absolutely fun.
And then there's the Tin Man gene, and that's they called it the Tin Man gene because it's the master switch for heart development. Mm. I wonder if there's a straw man gene for fright.
For brains, there should be. <that's> So, Fred, the evolutionists have come up now with Herbalitaria, a make-believe organism that they say predates, you know, snails and kangaroos and everything. And they say it had the blueprint for eyes and limbs and hearts millions of years. In fact, Fred, 50 million years before there were such things as eyes and limbs and pumping circulatory systems. So this destroys natural selection, because if the blueprint can exist in some ancient make-believe creature tens of millions of years before they're needed, then it can't be natural selection that formed it.
Exactly.
It just can't be. So they're going to have to dump, not only did they dump the tree of life, now they're going to have to dump natural selection.
They're going to start worshiping Herbalitaria, is what they call this thing. Yeah. They're going to say it's an alien from...
We could make money, build a temple to Herbalitaria. Yeah. All right, Fred Williams, thanks so much for joining us here in studio at Bob and Yurt Live with another edition of Real Science Friday.
It was great, Bob. Thanks for having me.
God bless you. Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada. And please help us at Bob and Yurt Live.